today, but I would like to introduce some students who are here with us this morning on the Court with Class program. We have students from Mishicot High School. Would they please stand? Welcome. We're delighted you're with us. You may be seated. And we have students from North Central Technical College. Would they please stand? Thank you. We're delighted to have you, too. The students have received materials about these cases, and there's additional material out on the table in the foyer. I know that the court has met the students. We'd like you to meet us. And so I'll start on my left. That's Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his right is Justice Jeanine Geske. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right, Justice John Wilcox. And to Justice Wilcox's right, Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. You will be meeting with Justice Bradley at noon, along with some of your colleagues from Michigan High School. So if you will remain seated after the case is finished, Justice Bradley will be out to meet you in a few moments. I'll call the second case today, which is 96-2753, Roberta Joe W. versus Leroy W. et al. Representing the petitioner, appellant is Shane John Vanderwaal. You may take the podium.
May it please the court, counselors, good morning. My name is Shane Vanderwaal, and I represent the appellant Roberta Joe W. in this action. Now, I must admit before starting here, I feel a little bit nervous being in front of this court, especially given the vast experience of the respondent's counsel here. In any event,
we all started sometimes. We recognize the experience, especially those who appeared as counsel here.
I took poker with people like you, too.
What's that? In any event, I submit to this court that the respondent, Leroy W., should be required to pay child support to my client, the appellant, from her date of birth through her high school graduation. I want to begin my discussion with what I believe is the linchpin of this case, and that's the interpretation of section 767.51 sub 4. As I've cited in my brief, there are two court of appeals cases on point which interpret 767.514 as I urge this court to interpret that meaning, and that is it should apply to the appellant or any child no matter when they start their paternity action, as long as it's within their 19 years of their date of birth back to the date of birth through their high school graduation. In fact, the respondent attempts to argue, if I understand the argument correctly, that the words in section 767.514 shall be limited to the support for the commencement after the birth of the child should somehow be understood as only applying to paternity actions that are commenced prior to the birth of the child, or, and if there's a paternity action after the birth of the child, the respondent and the father is only responsible for child support from the filing of the petition. However, as I've indicated, I submit that interpretation is incorrect. If the court would look to...
Mr. Vanderwaal, let me interrupt you for a minute and ask you why you think that your client is the one who would be entitled to support funds from the date of her birth until the date of her graduation. Why are those dollars something that she would be entitled to rather than, for instance, her mother, or rather than, for instance, the state of Wisconsin?
Well, with respect to my client, specifically Justice Crooks, Gomez versus Perez, I believe, indicates that a child born out of wedlock, the child born out of wedlock, has a judicially enforceable right to needed support from their natural fathers. Now, I understand that a lot of times that support goes to the mother to help raise that child, but fundamentally, child support, by its very definition, is the child's monies that they're entitled to. In fact, under the 80, going back to the 1985-86 version of Section 767-51 sub 4, the language the legislature used was that father's liability for past support shall be limited to support for the period after the and then commencement of the action. No one disputes that the language in 1985-86 version, what it really meant was that if a paternity action was filed in year 10 of a child's life, that from year 10 forward, the father would pay child support. Now, in
let me follow up, because I don't think you're completely answering my question. My understanding of the facts in this particular case is that at least for a period of time, the mother of your client was receiving AFDC benefits. Those benefits were provided, obviously, by the taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin and dollars that came also from the federal government, you know, so in a roundabout way, again, from the taxpayers. Why shouldn't there be a claim by the taxpayers or by the state of Wisconsin for some of what your client is now claiming?
I guess the quick answer, Justice, is that the state has not presented a claim in this matter for those monies.
Does that then mean that your client is entitled to $1 from the date of her birth until the day of graduation?
Well,
just because the state has not sued or her mother has not sued?
Well, 893.88 indicates that it's the child's, my client's, cause of action.
Where does it so indicate? What language are you relying on?
I'm sorry?
What language are you relying on?
In 893.88, I'm relying on the language. As interpreted under the
Give us the number again, I'm sorry. 893 what?
893.88, as the language is interpreted by the Court of Appeals in James L. And the language of 893.88 states, the pertinent part states that an action for the establishment of the paternity of a child shall be commenced within 19 years at the date of the birth of the child or be barred. Now the courts, this court's, in fact, previous interpretation, the Court of Appeals and previous interpretations, I believe in James A.O. as well as D.L.T., and I apologize if I get the name of the case incorrect, indicates that it's the child's cause of action.
Well, that's for paternity, but now we're into support.
That's for paternity, correct. And to answer Justice Crooks' question, yes, Justice, one of the factors, one of the consequences if this court rules, as I'm requesting it to rule, is that this matter will be remanded back down to the trial court where Judge Fleischauer will make a decision pursuant to Section 767-51 sub 4M through 5. To determine the amount of child support.
Well, let me ask you the question. What's the determination? I mean, we've got a young woman who's over 18 years old and a high school graduate and obviously been supported because she's physically there and money came in. What's for the trial judge to determine as to what she should receive up and above whatever support she received from parents or from the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I think the first step that I will argue to the trial judge and then submit to this court is that the first step is Section 767-51 sub 4M, I believe, requires the trial court to use the percentage guidelines, the 17%.
Let me ask this question another way. Let's assume this young woman were 15 years old. And let's assume that... the mother of the child is also part of the cause of action for support. Who is entitled to receive that support money when she's 15 years old? Whose money is that? Assuming that the father gets ordered to pay 17%, whose is it?
I think it's the child's money, but the mother is the guardian of that money, and that money is to be used to support the child for the mother who is the guardian.
Now, if the mother says, I am going to fully support this child and take care of this child, and I don't want him to pay any child support, she doesn't need any child support, it is your position that the child can still force the father to pay some money and put it into some account or something for the child?
Yes, I do.
So the question is, basically, we're being asked to interpret these two statutes, but we're looking at a public policy issue, and you think it's appropriate public policy that the child should be getting, I would use a windfall, because actually what dollars would Judge Fleischauer be looking? He would simply be speculating. So we're looking at a public policy question of why this court should allow child support from age 0 to 19 to someone who basically had received support rather than the mother or the state having some interest or receiving some money. So it's not clear, certainly in 893-88, as Justice Abrahamson pointed out, Chief Justice Abrahamson, that only deals with paternity, and you're taking that and stretching it into that this means that there should be child support paid. So it's a question of policy, public policy, that this court would be deciding if we were to, let's say, answer your argument in your favor.
That's correct. It is a policy consideration, and I believe that's why the Court of Appeals in District 4 certified it to this court.
I'm going to piggyback this question, and then if you want to give more answer to Justice Wilcox. My question, in conjunction with Justice Wilcox, is if the mother were a party to this at this point, where she's 18 and a half, and the mother says, look, I supported this child, the state of Wisconsin, I'm entitled to all the money, the 17%, to reimburse me for the expenses that I paid solely for this child, is it your position that the child is entitled to any of those monies? I mean, if her mother were part of this lawsuit.
If the mother were part of the lawsuit, I think that would be an issue for the trial court, again, on the remand, to determine, A, how much support ought to be paid, and B, I guess, who should that support for reimbursement in part of reimbursement?
We're talking reimbursement of child support at this point, aren't we?
I'm not talking about...
Well, she's not entitled to child support as of the time she files the action. You're talking about past support.
Correct.
So it's reimbursement of monies for the support of that child from age 0 to age 18 or graduation from high school.
I guess I would phrase the policy question sort of to try and answer your question to Justice Geske and Justice Wilcox. To answer your question, the policy consideration is not whether the appellant should obtain a windfall when she's been adequately supported through her majority. My client has been indigent throughout this pendency of this matter, as the court knows. My client's mother has had to seek public assistance, as pointed out by Justice Crooks. The question, and I think the policy consideration this court needs to determine, is whether the father should be legally responsible for supporting their children. In this case, the respondent has had the luxury of 18 and a half years of not concerning himself with my client.
But factually, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but factually, the district attorney's office, right after the birth of your client, informed this individual, as well as I think others, that there would be no action, and that so he, at least for 18 and a half years, was not aware that there was going to be any action, and then, of course, is brought in at a later time. That does not justify anything as far as the paternity, but what I'm more concerned about is the support in the dollars that you're seeking from him and where those dollars are going to be going.
Well, I guess at this point, the dollars will be going ultimately to whatever the trial court determines the dollars are necessary for my client will go to her. The mother has not brought the cause of action.
Counsel, if I read your briefs correctly and I read opposing counsel's correctly, the issue of whether we've got the right plaintiff here is not raised.
Correct.
The issue that the court is speaking about now is, do you have the right plaintiff? That is, should the mother or whoever supported this child be suing for the money? Or is it the child? It's your position that it is the child's money and you have the right plaintiff. There's some question raised about that. I don't think that you've got a case or a statute that supports your position. If you have, I'd like to hear about it. If not, I think that we ought to proceed for the moment to the issues that you have raised. When we get to opposing counsel, we ought to come back to this issue for a few moments and then move on to the issue. So assuming we have the right plaintiff, which may be a large assumption here, assuming that, what are the issues you want to discuss?
The other issue was justice.
And I write you didn't raise this issue. This is not raised in this case.
As to the appropriate plaintiff,
right.
The issue is not raised.
Assuming now that we have the appropriate plaintiff.
Assuming we have the appropriate plaintiff, the question becomes under Section 767.514 whether my client, the appellant adult child, is entitled to child support back to a date of birth. I would submit to the court, first, by way of analogy, this court has decided in Reeves versus Griffin that, which overruled that part of Hamu, stating that a contempt action cannot be brought after a child is an adult. The rationale behind the court's decision in that was that we don't want to encourage parents to elude the court process, and if they elude it long enough, that is, till the child reaches the age of majority, then they will never be responsible for child support.
Counsel, I'd like to get to the heart of what concerns me about your case, and that's not sub 4, but it's sub 3. Because it appears to me, anyway, that sub 3 is a legislative recognition that this all has to come to an end at some point. And it seems to define the end as being when the child is no longer pursuing an accredited course of instruction. And I think the facts here are undisputed, are they not? That she had her high school degree.
Correct.
So why doesn't sub 3 act as a bar to you?
Because as I read sub 3, Justice, sub 3 only sets out the time periods to which the appellant is entitled to child support. 893.88 in the case of James A.O. stated that the Court of Appeals stated...
Sorry, counsel, you have to stand in front of the microphone.
I'm sorry.
Otherwise, you're not being taped. And if we want to listen to you later, we'll miss you.
Okay. I don't know if I do, but...
But it's our choice.
The section 893.88 in James A.O., the Court of Appeals in James A.O. stated that during the 19-year, if an adult child brings a paternity action within the 19 years, that action may be brought for a number of reasons, for unlimited reasons. One of those reasons I submit to this court that the appellant has brought this action is for child support from her date of birth through her high school graduation.
So that's all you're asking for. You're asking for support from birth to 19, to the time she finished school.
We are not asking for it, and I would agree with the Justice's reading of Section 761.751 sub 3, and I do not submit to the court in any way that my client is entitled to support at the present time or from any time from, in this case, from the time she graduated from high school.
Your position is that under the, I think, under the statute of limitations, she can sue any time until she's 19.
Correct.
That when she sues before she's 19, she's entitled to recovery support for birth until either 19 or she gets a diploma.
Correct. But in this case, it was upon, she was 18 years and 3 months old, I believe, so it was until her high school graduation.
Okay.
And that is consistent, as I indicated, with the Court of Appeals decision in James A.O.
When James A.O., she was open, or he was over 19 when he sued, right?
He was 26.
Right, and he said that that was barred under, the statute of limitations, 893-88.
Correct.
And so you read 761.513 as a substantive provision that says, this is the amount you can order, not the time that you order it. It's an amount that is determined from birth to diploma.
I read, and I submit to the court that this interpretation is correct. When you read section 767.514 in conjunction with, which is the date of birth statute,
right,
in conjunction with 767.513, and in conjunction with the statute of limitations and the James A.O. case, which concerned a challenge to the statute of limitations, my client is entitled to child support, and I believe the policy considerations, justices, that we're looking at is requiring a father from a non-marital child to support that child. The respondent here did have notice. Not only, but I don't want the court to understand that notice to the father is an integral part of this case, because it is not.
Let me just raise this with you, and maybe it's sort of a pragmatic concern of mine, and doesn't, maybe it doesn't fit into the statutory scheme. Here's the concern of mine, that a child is born out of wedlock, and the parent, presumably the mother, decides not to name the father or proceed with paternity action, and doesn't want the father in the picture, doesn't notify the father, doesn't, so that you don't have to worry about custody, you don't have to worry about those visitation issues, all those messy things that occur where you have two interested parents. And we'll just wait until this child is 18 and a half, and then let the child go into court and say, I want 17% of this putative father's income for the last 18 years as a nest egg for me. There's something about that makes me very uncomfortable, and maybe that's what the statute said, but I guess I'd like you to address it, because, I mean, you argue that notice is an integral part, and I think that probably makes sense, but then you can have somebody out there who has no idea that they have a child in the world, and suddenly gets sued when this child is 18 and a half, and say, by the way, I want a portion of your income for the last 18 years.
But see, we're characterizing this as a nest egg for the appellant, and this is not a nest egg for the appellant. I'm only asking that the court make the respondent responsible for something, his actions of 18 and a half years ago, which clearly he remembers those actions.
He's not going to get back. He's not going to get back, if he wanted it, the right to visit, the right to have an integral part in that child's life. All that's gone. We don't have an eluding father here. We have got somebody. And so that's my concern.
But I think the basis of 893.88, Justice Geske, is that we want to avoid situations where the mother, because of community disapproval by the family members, maybe with the intent of, I want to stay with father, so I'm not going to raise this. And this is why it comes back ultimately to the child. Who is hurt in those situations but the child? Because, as in this case, the appellant's mother has had to seek county support, at least during a small portion of this child's life, and she's always been considered a borderline with respect to public support money. It's not a windfall or a nest egg for the appellant. I'm asking this court to make a policy consideration and a policy determination that we are going to hold fathers responsible whether, and my client has that right. That is why, and one reason, and I think in Gerhardt and PJW said it by the respondent, the court talks at length about prior to 1981, only the district attorney could bring the action, and there was a long analysis as to the different interests of the district attorney's office, the mother, and then, of course, the child.
Counsel, I think that normally when there is a child support to be paid, that the county asks for the people who might be responsible as far as being the father. And maybe, as you point out, as I noticed, there were three possible individuals. The county perhaps had some responsibility in the determining or making a determination at that time and chose not to, as I understand the facts, because they were aware of the names of these individuals at the time of birth. Is that correct?
The county was aware.
In other words, before you receive child support, before you can receive child support, there's an obligation of the mother of the child to indicate who she'd had sexual intercourse with so that the county can pursue the responsible party. Is that right or wrong? Isn't there a policy like that?
I think in 1976 that was the policy.
That was the policy.
Because as the facts in this case illustrate, the district attorney's office contacted the mother shortly before or after. Yeah. And then I'm not sure why, Justice Wilcox, why the county or the district attorney's office chose not to pursue the prosecution of this. But my client, now that she is attained 18 years old, is able to make those decisions on her behalf, has taken the act and the step to determine, A, who her father was, and to make the determination that because he is her father, he should have been and he should be liable for child support, and it is not a windfall. And very briefly, I want to add that...
I think you should start concluding, counsel.
I'll get to the conclusion, is that...
No, I mean now.
Right now. Equity concerns do not require the child support guidelines to be applied in this case on remand, and that's for the trial court to determine how much child support, if any, my client is entitled to on remand. Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Now I have, you can explain your division of time in 20 and 10 minutes. Counsel, go ahead.
My name is Russ Gallo. I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case, Leroy W. Our division of time is 20 minutes for me and 10 minutes for Mr. Formella on this case. I'd like to try and put at rest at least one issue why the mother and why the county or a governmental agency is not pursuing this case, and that is because the statute of limitations barred their claims. If you track back the statute of limitations, initially 893-88 was amended in 1981, I believe, which may have preserved the county and the mother's claims if it would have included them as protected parties. I believe the initial enactment of 893-88 said that the child, only the child, has until 19. Its present form doesn't limit it to the child to bring the action till 19. The predecessor to 893-88 did. And if you track back that there was a gap, and there was a 6 years, and there was a savings clause in there, and Chapter 990 came into play, but there are two cases, and I don't want to get into that, that explain that transition period. And if you go through those two cases, they clearly explain the transition period and say that the municipality or the county or the state's claim, as well as the mother's claim, would be barred by those statute of limitations. Initially it was 5 years, then 6 years, then 893-88.
Statute of limitations for support.
Yes.
Okay. Is it a support or for paternity?
That was, at the time, it was to bring the entire action, and I haven't looked at it specifically like I have at the present statute. specifically for that purpose as to how the statute is phrased. I think the courts and everybody else looked at it and assumed that it applied to all purposes and not really specifically looked at the specific wording. Was it for support? Was it for paternity? Or was it for a combination?
Well, it's going to be two separate issues. That
yes.
Once paternity was determined, let's assume that this minor was under the age of 18 and paternity was determined, whether or not the mom could come in and ask for support after that determination was made, even though she might not be able to be a party to the paternity action.
That's correct. The predecessor to 89388, which was also 890 to the present 89388, applied only to paternity. What I was referring to earlier was the prior statutes of limitation before the initial 89388 was enacted.
What were the cases to which you're referring, Kevin?
That's okay. When you were asking those questions. I cited it in the appellate court brief.
Okay.
I didn't cite it in this court's brief.
Why don't you give us those afterwards as well as to counsel? I gather from your response to my question and to Justice Geske's question, though, that the cases don't specifically separate paternity and support, and that may still be an open question. Is that a correct?
I haven't looked at those cases in preparation because I didn't think the statute of limitations that was in effect back in 1976 was an issue, simply because the present statute says she has until 19 to commence a paternity action, and that's one of the arguments that dovetails into one of our arguments here.
Okay.
Counsel, I note 767 is actions affecting the family, so paternity actions come within that umbrella. Is that correct?
Correct.
I take it you are not contesting that she has the right to bring a paternity action under 89388 since it's within 19 years. Is that correct?
That is correct. I wouldn't necessarily put it that way. I would say she has the right to bring an action to determine paternity within 19 years. If you want to take that and say paternity action necessarily includes the right to bring support, I dispute that.
Can she bring a support action under 767-08, which reads, if a person fails or refuses to provide for the support and maintenance of his or her spouse or minor child, any of the following may commence an action in any court having jurisdiction in actions affecting the family, ergo my initial question, to compel the person to provide any legally required support and maintenance. People that can bring the action, the statute goes on to say, an action to compel support are, number one, the person's spouse, number two, the person's minor child, number three, the person with legal custody of the child, number four, a non-legally responsible relative. Why cannot, if paternity is determined within the statute of limitations period, and if under 767.51.4, a father terminating paternity is liable for dollars since birth, why doesn't 767.08 allow for this child to bring the action?
Because, first of all, the exclusive procedure dealing with paternity actions is that starts at 767.45.
Well, my first question to you was whether or not paternity was an action affecting the family, and you answered in the affirmative. 767.08 sub 2 says any court having jurisdiction in actions affecting the family compel the person to provide any legally required support and maintenance, and then list four persons. So
then I inappropriately conceded because it is covered under the statute. It is covered under Chapter 767. I didn't anticipate the question being because the statute very clearly, 767.45, very clearly says that for purposes of support in paternity actions, 767.45 to 767.60 are the exclusive procedures and they cannot be waived.
So the language in 767.08 sub 2 saying courts having jurisdiction in actions affecting the family you sense does not relate back to the heading of 767, actions affecting the family, which encompasses paternity?
No, it does not affect actions involving paternity where support is an issue, because 767.45 says it doesn't.
Where does it say that?
In 767.45, Your Honor. Excuse me, 767.45 sub 5M commences, and you can skip down to after the initial citation to 767.45 and 767.60. It says, except as provided in sections 767.62 and 769.401, the exclusive procedure for establishment of child support obligations, and then you go on, legal custody, physical placement, rights for a man who is neither presumed the child's father under Section 891.41 nor adjudicated the father, is by an action under Section 767.45 to 767.60 or under 769.701.
Could you, again, I wasn't following where you're reading from. Could you give me the reference to that site?
It's 767.45 sub 5M, and we've cited that in our brief as one of the reasons why you can't bootstrap a statute of limitations onto Section 767 for purposes of increasing the period that was previously declared by the court and by the legislature for expanding support obligation to an adult. And with some of the other reasons...
Mr. Gallo, let me interrupt you for a minute, if I might. How do you handle the language that was pointed out from James A. O. To the effect that it's perfectly all right to bring an action as long as it's within the time frame of 893.88 for unlimited purpose in regard to paternity?
If you look at that case, Your Honor, the particular petitioner was not asking for support. Petitioner in that case was simply asking for a declaration of paternity. Support was not an issue. For the court to go further and say the statute of limitations authorizes actions for unlimited purposes would be dicta, because that issue was not before the court. It wasn't analyzed by the court as this court is analyzing it in this case. You have to, it's a very complicated statutory framework that we are dealing with, and to take a broad, especially in light of the statute I just cited that says 767.45 to 767.60, the other few statutes really aren't applicable, you can check that out for yourselves, are the exclusive procedure. How then do you bootstrap a statute of limitations in 893 and bring it under 767.45 to 60 and permit this type of claim when the legislature says this is the exclusive way you can do it? To permit support is what I'm talking about, because that's what 767.45.5M is talking about, the child support obligation.
Okay, let me ask you this. Suppose she was 17 and still in high school. Could she bring this lawsuit against your client?
She would have the right to bring this lawsuit against my client.
So, if she brings this lawsuit a day before she graduates, it's okay. That's how you read the statute. So if she brings it a day after she graduates, it's not okay. If she brings it a day before she graduates, she can get support money from birth to diploma.
No, in fact, Mr. Fermel asked me the same question, and he suggested you would ask me that question.
Okay.
And so
I'm glad I played into your hands. So now
my answer is this. This action is started out as one for paternity and was intended for a declaration of paternity and then changed into one for paternity and support. My response to this action is, until the legislature is permitted under 893.88 her to bring an action for a declaration of paternity until she turns 19. The support issue is a different issue. If we get to then the specific issue that you asked, and that is if she was 17 and therefore still a child, still a minor, not an adult, and brings this action, my response is very simply that given the way the legislature has phrased 767, 51, 4, in that one-sentence amendment that says, shall be limited, and given the law that existed at that time when that statute was changed, and given the statutory framework that was also adopted by the legislature in the same act as 767-51-4, they enacted a procedure, a scheme, that with a birth certificate, and this is referred to in our brief, the statute specifically says, if the birth certificate does not name a parent, and this is all part of the father, then an action has to be commenced within 6 months. So what I'm trying to get to, Your Honor, is I don't think the legislature, by the use of the language, shall be limited, can be attributed an intent to disregard concepts of notice of this potential obligation and go back to birth.
Okay, I'm going to ask the question again. I don't understand your answer.
Okay.
If she is 17, I'm going to do it with a minor and with an adult. If she's 17 and she sues for paternity and support, but I'm interested in the support, okay? That's what this case is about. She sues for support and she hasn't gotten a high school diploma. Can that case proceed, in your opinion? Yes or no?
She can proceed for present support until she turns 18 or until she graduates. Past support, retroactive support, no.
Why not?
Because I thought I was explaining that in my prior answer. The use of the language shall be limited to the period of time after birth is rather curious choice of language to accomplish this retroactive calculation of support to birth.
Yeah.
If they want, and because of this, and I think this court in Yistad, Schultz versus Yistad, went through what happened. This same law was adopted by that same act that was at issue in that case. The legislature was well aware of retroactive support obligations.
Right. Are you then saying to me she never can get retroactive support?
She
sues at 2, she can only get from 2 on, not before 2. If she sues at 3, 3 on. Is that your position?
From the time of notice, yes.
But what about the case of
Brad Michael?
Yeah.
The appellate court. I think that was an inappropriate construction. I don't think it was ever petitioned to this court. I don't think that was a correct construction of this statute because it didn't take into account the additional statutes that were enacted by the same legislative act, which is what I was getting to. The legislative scheme, when it adopted this statute, would have required a lawsuit to be commenced because no father was listed on the birth certificate within 6 months of the date of birth. That was the legislative scheme. At the same time, the legislature was confronted with the issue of removing child support enforcement dollars from the federal government because previously this court had permitted a retroactive decrease in support. So at the same time, they adopted, in the same act, adopted the statute that said you cannot increase or decrease support and make it effective before the date of notice. That is all part of this same act that gave rise to this change in language, shall be limited to the period after the birth. I don't think you can attribute to the legislature an intent by use of that language to completely disregard existing case law that says you got to give notice when they're saying, in this scenario, you have to commence the suit within 6 months of birth and make it retroactive 18 years.
If you prevail, do we have to overrule Brad Michael? Do we have to?
Not in this case. This case is not the Brad Michael scenario. In that case, I believe we had a 15 or 17-year-old child.
But if we leave Brad Michael out there and we rule for you, don't we have sort of a ridiculous situation, as expounded by the question put to you by the chief, that under Brad Michael, at least if she sued one day before she graduated, she gets support all the way back to the date of birth. If she sues one day after, she gets no support. And then here we're saying since she sued one day after, she gets zero.
I would prefer you to overrule Brad Michael and set the record and do a good legislative review of all the statutes that were enacted at the same time as this statute that amended and said shall be limited to the time after birth, because you will find out the scheme adopted was the scheme I just outlined. If there's no father listed on the birth certificate, 6 months, you got to commence the action. That was the intent.
Counsel, I continue to be bothered by 76708, and I'm bothered by this, that if a child is born in wedlock, under 76708, actions affecting family compelling support, the child can bring an action for support, apparently. Is that your understanding of 76708?
I can't answer that question because I haven't studied that particular statute. It wasn't cited in the briefs.
Let me follow up. My concern is this. Arguably, under 76708, actions affecting family to compel support, a child born in wedlock can bring a action for support. And the question I have, two questions, if a child is not born with parents married, but father listed on the birth certificate, can, and therefore you don't have to have a paternity action, can a child bring an action for support? I would guess the answer is yes under 76708. But then my final concern is, what if paternity isn't established until 3 months? No listing of dad on the birth certificate. Paternity isn't established until 3 months after birth. Under your interpretation of 76745M, that child whose paternity is established 3 months after birth doesn't have the same rights as a child who's born in wedlock or not born in wedlock, but the dad's name is on the birth certificate. I'm troubled by that. Is there any solution to that?
I guess I'm not sure I follow the question from the standpoint of, if you have a child born in wedlock and the parents are together or not together, if they're together at the time the child is born, can that child be a parent for support?
Earlier when I was asking you about 76708, you said that doesn't apply because this is a paternity action. And under 765, paternity actions are exclusively within
No, that's not what I said, because 76745-5M says the exclusive procedure for establishing child support in this paternity action is set forth there.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Why can a child who is born in wedlock bring a cause of action for support against dad, but a child who is born not in wedlock not have that right?
I don't know the answer to the first part of your question. I don't know that a child born in wedlock can bring an action for support against dad under any circumstances.
Do you want me to read again 76708 sub 2?
No.
That was a threat. Assuming that that's what it says, how can you justify the difference?
Your Honor, you have me at a disadvantage because I have not read 76708 for purposes of this because it was not cited to me previously.
So
I would be happy to supply the court with my, after I've had a chance to read it, and see what the what cases have said about that statute.
The issue is an equal protection one, if Justice Bradley is right. So, now, you've got a couple of seconds to sum up.
Very simply, I think, first of all, the fundamental issue in this case is whether an adult can bring a claim for support. I think that issue is answered very clearly by 767-51-3. I think that was conceded in argument here. Without that, without a present right to support, you can't use a statute of limitations to bootstrap and, in essence, pull a real nice magic trick and say, we are going to calculate support, give support to this child in her majority, which is prohibited by the case law and the statute, but we're going to calculate it on the basis of what would have been provided had she been a child and had this been commenced many years ago. I don't think that can be done. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Formelli, you represent Portage County Corporation Counsel's Office.
Thank you. May it please the court and respected counsel, my name is Brian Formella and I am Corporation Counsel for Portage County, the intervener respondent in this case. Portage County became aware of this matter at the point that the petitioner requested the trial court to extend her court-appointed counsel from just the trial court level to the appellate level. I appeared on behalf of Portage County at that time and then formally intervened at the Court of Appeals level. The issue that I addressed, therefore, is not the initial issue here this morning, of course, but the correctness, in our opinion, of the trial judge's decision to cut off or to avoid Portage County's responsibility for attorney's fees for the petitioner at the appellate court level. Basically, we find that it was probably error for the trial court to initially appoint counsel for the petitioner in this case because the petitioner at that point in time was already an adult, and so we believe that although we're not challenging that decision at this point in time, we believe it was probably an erroneous exercise of discretion.
Mr. Formella, let me interrupt. Didn't Portage County originally petition the trial court for appointment of counsel?
The child support agency did do that.
But do you claim that the child support agency is separate from Portage County? Isn't it the Portage County Child Support Agency?
Yes and no. There are features that make it similar, or I should say have both. But the state child support agency, it's really a function, in my opinion, I think through the state, the statute and the construct, to be a state office. It's housed in Portage County. To make matters even a little more challenging and to concede what you're saying is that the attorney who moved that truly was an assistant corporation counsel at that time. And yet, in that capacity, she was not corporation counsel or assistant corporation counsel, but really state's attorney for the state child support agency. Now, what I've done, obviously, is I've filed a...
We don't need to figure this out, do we?
I'm sorry?
We don't need to figure that out, do we?
No, but I filed a notice of waiver, or I've asked both sides to waive any apparent conflict because it is a little confusing, but I think it's clear that agency is fundamentally distinct and discrete from Portage County, the state child support agency that's housed in the county.
Let me ask you a factual question. Did your request to the trial court to terminate the appointment of counsel come after the filing of a notice of appeal?
No. My office, and this isn't part of the record, but let me just give you that chronology. My office became aware of the intent of petitioner's counsel to seek appellate review of the decision of no back child support. I think there was some thinking that my office may have something to say about that when informally, and we really don't. I mean, but counsel for petitioner was kind enough to notice the corporation counsel office for whatever wisdom or position that we, Portage County, as the keeper of the tax trust, if you will, the taxpayers, had to say about the issue of an adult child whose a paternity has already been established to have appellate counsel paid for at county expense.
I guess my concern is, when did the order come terminating the appointment? Did it come after there was a notice of appeal filed?
No, it came prior. The notice of appeal, the judge ruled first in August of 96, and this is in the appendix, and then again upon a motion for reconsideration in September of 96, again, to deny petitioner's request for continuation of county-provided counsel. Thereafter, of course, came the notice of appeal. We, Portage County Corporation Counsel Office, appeared both at the August initial motion and at the motion for reconsideration in September, both times setting forth our opinion that the case law of Charkas v. Scow and that Joni B. Don't apply to this case.
And so, in my opinion, what the trial court judge did, and this is at my appendix in my brief, starting at A8, that the trial court, basically went through an analysis as to why, in his opinion, it was questionable at best that there was a counsel appointed for Roberta Cho in the first instance. He undid that. He basically felt that Joni B. and Scow doesn't apply in that matter. He went through, in my opinion, his analysis, which corrected his initial decision that came from the child support attorney requesting counsel. In my opinion, that was probably a gratuitous move on the part of the child support agency attorney at that point in time.
Is it your position that when faced with this kind of determination, a trial judge should not apply the Joni B. Approach?
Well, Joni B., I think, talks really to two approaches. And I think there are three, quite frankly, I like the wisdom of the amicus brief in this case. There are three basic bases by which courts can appoint counsel. One is a statutory basis. There is no statutory basis here, I think, if you look through for an appointment for Roberta Cho in this case. The second basis is constitutional due process. I think if the court did a careful analysis, there's not a constitutional due process right here to a court-appointed counsel. There's no there's no liberty interest at stake. The property interest is not yet extant. It's trying to be developed. There is the county, the state's interest has been largely met. There has been a paternity established. And I can go through those analyses, but I think I do that in my brief as well, to say that the constitutional realm, there's just not a good constitutional setting here for arguing that there's a basis for an attorney appointment. The last basis, then, that Joni B. discusses is the inherent authority of the court. Charkas discusses that as well. That has to be predicated on the efficiencies of justice, the efficiencies of the administration of justice for the benefit of the trial court. Now, in this instance, the trial court, in the first instance, never made that determination that it, the trial court, needed counsel appointed for its efficient administration.
Did Judge Fleischauer make the initial appointment?
He did.
And so he actually questioned then the wisdom of his initial correctness.
In the second instance, yes, in August and September of 96, he did do exactly that, and that's in the record. So he did question that, and we think correctly. And so we would ask this court to affirm that, that his thinking in the second instance, that whereby he corrected, in our opinion, his initial decision, although he doesn't use that language. The other thing that...
Portage County paid the fees, correct?
I'm sorry?
Portage County paid the fees.
Yes, indeed.
The initial appointment.
That's correct.
Why did you get... Maybe this has nothing to do with anything, but why did you get involved so late?
We, the Portage County, the Corporation Counsel side of this equation, just was unaware of what was going on. It was a year or two later when counsel for a petitioner came to me and basically said, how do I feel about this? And I said, well, to represent my client, we don't like it, or at least we want to be heard on the issue. They were kind enough to notify us of that. We just didn't have that the opportunity to be heard earlier on that. Although there is that distinction that Justice Crooks talks about, they looked like they could be, they were separate entities, and one hand didn't know what the other was doing. The last issue I'd like to point out or make sure that we touch on here is 809.85, which is basically a statute that says that counsel appointed by the trial court continues at the appellate court level. There's nary a case citing that, but that I submit to the court that statute ought not to cause you any concern here for just Judge Fleischauer's pulling out appellate counsel at county expense. 809.85 really is instructive to counsel and not instructive or prohibitory to the trial judges that if they have an inherent authority to appoint counsel in the first instance, they certainly have authority to revisit that issue in the second instance, which the trial court did here. So if you review 809.85, and you'll see that it says that counsel appointed at the trial court level will continue through, that ought not to, in my opinion, in any way, shape, or form, mitigate or proscribe the trial courts from revisiting its own decision for the appointment of counsel. It really speaks to the trial counsel's need to continue on in that representation.
Do you think the significance of 809.85 in this particular case disappears because of the fact that Judge Fleischauer made his decision before the notice of appeal?
I do. I think that that's one of the bases here for it. I think trial courts, and this court has been very generous too, is rightfully so, to trial courts' inherent authority for the appointment of counsel. I think it would be curious to now take away some of that inherent authority when it came at a pattern where, at a point where it did not prejudice the petitioner. The petitioner knew what the status of the case was. There can be no statement that the judge was trying to play the system or avoid appellate review. There's still a discretionary standard that has to be applied here. There's no question. The petitioner isn't saying that Judge Fleischauer abused or erroneously exercised his discretion. We would respectfully request that the court affirm the judge's decision.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Van de Waal.
Justice, I'd like to respond to a few of the comments by the respondent, Mr. Gala, first. First, with respect to the James A.O. case, the Court of Appeals in that case, and I understand that the case involved an adult child who was 26 years of age. However, the Court of Appeals, in examining that case, examined all areas of Section 893.88 and stated that, therefore, while the statute forecloses a longer time limit for purposes unrelated to child support, it also allows paternity actions for unlimited purposes during those 19 years. Now, I also have not researched Section 767.08 sub 2 that Justice Bradley has brought to issue. However, 893.88 is entitled the statute of limitations for paternity actions. I hope I did not give this court the intent that I concede at any point that I believe Section 767.513 somehow does not allow my client to obtain support. What I had proposed, and I tried to make this clear, was that she's entitled to support from her date of birth through her high school graduation as long as she brings that claim before she turns the age of 19.
Now, how do you interpret subsection 3?
I interpret subsection 3 as a limitation as to when the child support shall end. As I read subsection 3, it does not state in there that a claim must be brought before a child turns 18 or 19.